Because Day was working two jobs, Lawrence dropped out of school and spent most of his time taking care of his brothers and Deborah. But he wanted to get out of the house now and then to go to the pool halls. At 16, he was too young to get in. So he lied about his age and got himself a voter's registration card saying he was 18. No one could prove he was lying, since he'd been born on the home house floor and didn't have a birth certificate or social security card. But his plan backfired. Because of the Korean War, Congress had just lowered the minimum age for military service to 18 and a half, so Lawrence was drafted at 16. He was sent to Virginia, where he'd serve 2 years in a medic unit at Fort Belvoir. With Lawrence gone, someone else had to raise the Lacks children. No one told Sonny, Deborah, or Joe what had happened to their mother, and they were afraid to ask. Back then, the rule in the house was, do what adults say, otherwise you'll get hurt. They were to sit, hands folded, and not say a word unless someone asked them a question. As far as the children knew, their mother was there one day, gone the next. She never came back, and they got Ethel in her place. Ethel was the woman that Sadie and Henrietta once hid from on the dance floor. The one Sadie and Margaret swore was jealous of Henrietta. They called her that hateful woman. And when she and her husband Galen moved into the house, saying they were there to help with the children, Sadie and Margaret figured Ethel was trying to move in on Day. Soon, stories began spreading about Ethel sleeping with Day instead of Galen. A good handful of cousins still think Ethel moved into that house and started up with Day, just to get out all the hate she had for Henrietta by torturing her children. Henrietta's children grew up hungry. Every morning, Ethel fed them each a cold biscuit that had to last them until dinner. She put latches and bolts on the refrigerator and cupboard doors to keep the children out between meals. They weren't allowed ice in their water because it made noise. If they were good, she'd sometimes give them a slice of bologna or a cold wiener. Maybe pour the grease from her bacon pan onto their biscuit, or mix some water with vinegar and sugar for dessert. But she rarely thought they were good. Lawrence came home from the military in 1953 and moved into a house of his own. He had no idea what Ethel was doing to his brothers and Deborah. As the children grew, Ethel woke them at dawn to clean the house, cook, shop, and do the laundry. In the summers, she took them to Clover, where she'd send them into the fields to pick worms off tobacco leaves by hand. The tobacco juice stained their fingers and made them sick when it got in their mouths. But they grew used to it. The Lacks children had to work from sunup to sundown. They weren't allowed to take breaks, and they got no food or water until nightfall, even when the summer heat burned. Ethel would watch them from the couch or a window, and if one of them stopped working before she told them to, she'd beat them all bloody. At one point, she beat Sonny so badly with an extension cord, he ended up in the hospital. But Joe got the worst of Ethel's rage. Sometimes, she would beat Joe for no reason while he lay in bed or sat at the dinner table. She'd hit him with her fists, or whatever she had close, shoes, chairs, sticks. She made him stand in a dark basement corner on one foot, nose pressed to the wall, dirt filling his eyes. Sometimes she tied him up with rope and left him down there for hours. Other times she left him down there all night. If his foot wasn't in the air when she checked on him, she'd whip his back with a belt. If he cried, she'd just whip harder. And there was nothing Sonny or Deborah could do to help him. If they said anything, Ethel just beat them all worse. But after a while, it got to where the beatings didn't bother Joe. He stopped feeling pain. He only felt rage. The police came by the house more than once to tell Day or Ethel to pull Joe off the roof, where he was lying on his stomach, shooting strangers on the sidewalk with his BB gun. When the police asked what he thought he was doing up there, Joe told them he was practicing to be a sniper when he grew up. They thought he was joking. Joe grew into the meanest, angriest child any Lax had ever known, and the family started saying something must have happened to his brain while he was growing inside Henrietta alongside that cancer. In 1959, Lawrence moved into a new house with his girlfriend, Babette Cooper. 5 years earlier, she noticed Lawrence walking down the street in his uniform and fell for him instantly. Her grandmother warned her, "Don't mess with that boy. His eyes green, his army suit green, and his car green. You can't trust him." But Babette didn't listen. They moved in together when Babette was 20 and Lawrence was 24, and they had their first child that same year. They also found out that Ethel had been beating Deborah and her brothers. Babette insisted that the whole family move in with her and Lawrence, and she helped raise Sonny, Deborah, and Joe as if they were her own. Deborah was 10 years old. Though moving out of Ethel's house had ended the abuse for her brothers, it hadn't stopped for her. Ethel's husband, Galen, was Deborah's biggest problem, and he found her wherever she went. She tried to tell Day when Galen touched her in ways she didn't think he was supposed to, but Day never believed her, and Ethel just called Deborah words she'd never heard, like bitch and slut. In the car with Day driving and Ethel in the passenger seat, and everybody drinking except her, Deborah would sit in the back, pressed against the car door to get as far from Galen as she could. But he'd just slide closer. As Day drove with his arm around Ethel in front, Galen would grab Deborah in the back seat, forcing his hands under her shirt, in her pants, between her legs. After the first time he touched her, Deborah swore she'd never wear another pair of jeans with snaps instead of zippers again. But zippers didn't stop him. Neither did tight belts. So Deborah would just stare out the window, praying for Day to drive faster as she pushed Galen's hands away again and again. Then one day he called Deborah saying,
"Dale, come over here and get some money. Ethel wants you to pick her up some soda."
When Deborah got to Galen's house, she found him lying naked on the bed. She'd never seen a man's penis and didn't know what it meant for one to be erect or why he was rubbing it. She just knew it all felt wrong.
"Ethel wants a six-pack of soda," Galen told Deborah,
then patted the mattress beside him.
"The money's right here."
Deborah kept her eyes on the floor and ran as fast as she could, snatching the money off the bed, ducking when he grabbed for her, then running down the stairs with him chasing after her, naked and yelling,
"Get back here till I finish with you, Dale, you little whore! Just wait till I tell your father."
Deborah got away, which just made him madder. Despite the beating and the molesting, Deborah felt closer to Galen than she ever had to Day. When he wasn't hitting her, Galen showered her with attention and gifts. He bought her pretty clothes and took her for ice cream. In those moments, Deborah pretended he was her father and she felt like a regular little girl. But after he chased her through the house naked, it didn't seem worth it. And eventually, she told Galen she didn't want any more gifts.
"I'll get you a pair of shoes," he said, then paused, rubbing her arm. "You don't have to worry about anything. I'll wear a rubber. You don't have to worry about pregnant."
Deborah had never heard of a rubber, and she didn't know what pregnant was. She just knew she wanted him to leave her alone. Deborah had started scrubbing people's floors and ironing for small amounts of money. She'd try to walk home alone after work, but Galen would usually pick her up along the way and try to touch her in the car. One day, not long after her 12th birthday, he pulled up beside Deborah and told her to get in. This time, she kept walking. Galen jammed the car into park and yelled,
"You get in this damn car, girl!"
Deborah refused.
"Why should I get in?" she said. I ain't doing nothing wrong. It's still daylight, and I just walking down the street.
Your father looking for you, he snapped. Let him come get me then. You been doing things to my body you ain't supposed to do, she yelled. I don't want to be nowhere with you by myself no more. Lord gave me enough sense to know that.
She turned to run, but he hit her, grabbed her by the arm, threw her into the car, and kept right on having his way with her. A few weeks later, as Deborah walked home from work with a neighborhood boy named Alfred Cheetah Carter, Galen pulled up alongside them, yelling at her to get in the car. When Deborah refused, Galen raced up the street, tires screaming. A few minutes later, he pulled up beside her again, this time with Day in the passenger seat. Galen jumped out of the car, cussing and screaming and telling her she was a whore. He grabbed Deborah by the arm, threw her in the car, and punched her hard in the face. Her father didn't say a word, just stared through the windshield. Deborah cried the whole way home to Bobette and Lawrence's house, blood dripping from her split eyebrow, then leapt from the car and ran through the house, straight into the closet where she hid when she was upset. She held the door closed tight. Bobette saw Deborah run through the house crying, saw the blood on her face, and chased her to the closet. With Deborah inside sobbing, Bobette pounded on the door saying, "Dale, what the hell is going on?" Bobette had been part of the family long enough to know that cousins sometimes had their way with other cousins. But she didn't know about Galen hurting Deborah, because Deborah never told anyone. She was afraid she'd get in trouble. Bobette pulled Deborah from the closet, grabbed her shoulders, and said, "Dale, if you don't tell me nothing, I won't know nothing. Now, I know you love Galen like he your father, but you got to tell me what's going on." Deborah told Bobette that Galen had hit her and that he sometimes talked dirty to her in the car. She said nothing about Galen touching her because she was sure Bobette would kill him, and she worried that with Galen dead and Bobette in jail for murdering him, she'd have lost the two people who cared for her most in the world. Bobette stormed over to Galen and Ethel's house and burst in their front door screaming that if either of them touched one of those lax children again, she'd kill them herself. Soon after, Deborah asked Bobette what pregnant was. Bobette told her, then grabbed Deborah's shoulders again and told her to listen good.
"I know your mother and father and all the cousins all mingled together in their own way, but don't you ever do it, Dale.
Cousins are not supposed to be having sex with each other. That's uncalled for."
Deborah nodded.
"You promise me," Bobette said. "You fight them if they try and get with you. I don't care if you have to hurt them. Don't let them touch you."
Deborah promised she wouldn't.
"You just got to go to school," Bobette said. "Don't mess with boy cousins, and don't have babies until you're grown."
Deborah wasn't thinking about having babies anytime soon, but by the time she turned 13, she was thinking about marrying that neighbor boy everyone called Cheetah, mainly because she thought Galen would have to stop touching her if she had a husband. She was also thinking she'd drop out of school. Like her brothers, she'd always struggled in school because she couldn't hear the teacher. None of the lax children could hear much unless the person was speaking nearby, talking loud and slow. But they'd been taught to keep quiet with adults, so they never told their teachers how much they were missing. None of them would realize the extent of their deafness or get hearing aids until later in life. When Deborah told Bobette she wanted to leave school, Bobette said,
"Sit up front if you can't hear. I don't care what you do, but you get an education, because that's your only hope."
So Deborah stayed in school. She spent summers in Clover, and as she developed, her boy cousins would grab her and try to have their way. Sometimes they'd try to drag her into a field or behind a house. Deborah fought back with fists and teeth, and soon the cousins left her alone. They'd sneer at her, tell her she was ugly, and say,
"Damn mean. She born mean and she gonna stay mean."
Still, three or four cousins asked Deborah to marry them, and she just laughed, saying,
"Man, is you crazy? That ain't no game, you know. It affects the child."
Babette had told Deborah that maybe she and her siblings had hearing problems because their parents were first cousins. Deborah knew other cousins had children who were dwarves or whose minds never developed. She wondered if that had something to do with what happened to Elsie. Deborah didn't know she had a sister for much of her childhood. When Day finally told her, all he said was that Elsie was deaf and dumb and that she died in an institution when she was 15. Deborah was devastated. She demanded to know if anyone ever tried to teach her sister sign language. No one had. Deborah begged Lawrence to tell her about their sister, but the only thing he'd say was that she was beautiful and that he had to take her everywhere he went so he could protect her. Deborah couldn't shake the idea that since Elsie couldn't talk, she couldn't have said no to boys like Deborah did, or tell anyone if something bad happened. Deborah hounded Lawrence to tell her anything he remembered about their sister and mother. Eventually, he broke down sobbing and Deborah stopped asking. When she was in high school, Deborah cried and lay awake at night, worrying about what awful things might have happened to her mother and sister. She'd ask Day and her parents' cousins, "What in the world happened to my sister? And who was my mother? What happened to her?" Day just said the same thing again and again.
"Her name was Henrietta Lacks, and she died when you was too young to remember."
Chapter 16. Spending Eternity in the Same Place. 1999. During my first visit with Henrietta's cousin Cootie, as we sat drinking juice, he told me that no one ever talked about Henrietta. Not when she was sick, not after she died, and not now.
"We didn't say words like cancer," he told me, "and we don't tell stories on dead folks."
At that point, he said, the family had gone so long without talking about Henrietta, it was almost like she'd never existed, except for her children and those cells.
"It sounds strange," he said, "but her cells done lived longer than her memory."
If I wanted to know anything about Henrietta, he told me, I'd need to go up the road and talk to her cousin Cliff, who'd grown up with her like a brother. When I pulled into Cliff's driveway, he figured I was a Jehovah's Witness or an insurance sales rep, since the only white people who visited him were usually one or the other. He smiled and waved just the same, saying,
"How you doing?"
Cliff was in his 70s and still minding the tobacco barn behind the farmhouse his father had built decades earlier, checking the furnaces several times a day to make sure they stayed at 120 degrees. Inside Cliff's house, the electric blue and white walls were darkened with smudges of oil and dirt. He'd blocked the stairs to the second floor with cardboard and blankets to keep warm air from going up and out through missing windows, and he'd patched holes in his ceiling, walls, and windows with newspaper and duct tape. He slept downstairs on a thin, sheetless twin bed across from the refrigerator and wood stove, next to a folding table where he'd piled so many pills he'd forgotten what they were all for. Maybe the prostate cancer, he said. Maybe the pressure. Cliff spent most of his time on his porch, sitting in a plaid recliner so worn down it was mostly just exposed foam and springs, waving at each car that passed. He was about 6 feet tall, even with several inches of slouch, his light brown skin dry and weathered like alligator, his eyes sea green at the center, with deep blue edges. Decades in shipyards and tobacco fields had left his hands coarse as burlap, his fingernails yellowed, cracked, and worn to the cuticles. As Cliff talked, He stared at the ground and twisted his arthritic fingers, one over the other like he was crossing them all for good luck. Then he untwisted them and started again. When he heard I was writing a book about Henrietta, he got up from his recliner, pulled on a jacket, and walked over to my car, yelling, "Come on, then. I'll show you where she buried." About a half mile down Laxtown Road, Cliff had me park in front of a cinder block and pressed board house that couldn't have been more than 300 square feet inside. He jerked open a log and barbed wire gate that led into a pasture and motioned for me to walk through. At the end of the pasture, hidden in the trees, stood a slave-time log cabin covered in boards with gaps wide enough to see through. Its windows had no glass and were covered by thin pieces of wood and rusted Coke signs from the 50s. The house slanted, its corners resting on piles of rocks of varying sizes that had been holding it above ground for more than 200 years, its base high enough off the ground for a small child to crawl under.
"That there is the old home house where Henrietta grew up," Cliff yelled, pointing.
We walked toward it through red dirt and dried leaves that cracked under our feet, the air smelling of wild roses, pine, and cows.
"Henrietta kept it nice, a real home house. Now I can hardly recognize it."
The floors inside were covered with straw and manure. They'd collapsed in several places under the weight of cows that now roamed free on the property. Upstairs, in the room Henrietta once shared with Day, a few remnants of life lay scattered on the floor. A tattered work boot with metal eyes but no laces. A TrueAid soda bottle with a white and red label. A tiny woman's dress shoe with open toes. I wondered if it was Henrietta's.
"Could be," Cliff said. "Sure looked like her shoe."
He pointed toward what used to be the back wall, which had fallen years earlier, leaving little more than the frames of two tall windows.
"This is where Henrietta slept."
She used to lie on her stomach and stare out those windows, looking at the woods and the family cemetery. A small quarter-acre clearing where a few strands of barbed wire now surrounded a scattering of tombstones. The same cows that had trampled the home house floor had destroyed several sections of the cemetery fence. They'd left manure and hoof prints on graves, crushed flower arrangements into piles of stems, ribbon, and styrofoam, and knocked over several tombstones, which now lay flat on the ground next to their bases. When we got outside, Cliff shook his head and picked up fragments of a broken sign. One piece said, "We love," the other said, "Mom." Some of the family tombstones were homemade from concrete. A few were store-bought in marble.
"Them's the folks with some money," Cliff said, pointing to a marble one.
Many graves were marked with index card-sized metal plates on sticks with names and dates. The rest were unmarked.
"Used to be we'd mark them graves with a rock so we could find them," Cliff told me. "But the cemetery got cleaned out one time with the bulldozer, so that pretty much cleared those rocks on away."
"There were so many people buried in the Lax Cemetery now," he said. "They'd run out of room decades ago and started piling graves on top of each other." He pointed at an indentation in the ground with no marker beside it.
"This was a good friend of mine," he said.
Then he started pointing around the graveyard to other body-sized indentations in the dirt.
"See that sunk in right there? And that sunk in right there? And there? Them's all unmarked graves. They sink after a time when the dirt settled around the bodies."
Occasionally, he'd point to a small, plain rock poking through the earth and say it was a cousin or an aunt.
"That there's Henrietta's mother," he said,
pointing to a lone tombstone near the cemetery's edge, surrounded by trees and wild roses. It was several feet tall, its front worn rough and browned from age and weather. The inscription said this: "Eliza, Wife of J.R. Pleasant, July 12, 1888, October 28, 1924. Gone, but not forgotten. Until I read those dates, I hadn't done the math. Henrietta was barely 4 years old when she lost her mother. About the same age Sonny was when Henrietta died.
Henrietta used to come talk to her mother, took real good care of her grave. Now Henrietta's somewhere in here with her, Cliff said, waving his arms toward the clearing between Eliza's stone and the next tree a good 15 feet away. Never did get a marker, so I couldn't tell you exactly where she at. But the immediate family be buried next to each other, so she probably round in here somewhere.
He pointed to 3 body-sized indentations in the clearing and said,
Any one of those could be Henrietta.
We stood in silence as Cliff kicked at the dirt with his toe.
I don't know what happened on that deal with them cells from Henrietta, he said eventually. Don't nobody say anything about it round here. I just knowed she had something rare, 'cause she been dead a pretty good while, but her cell's still living, and that's amazing.
He kicked at the ground.
I heard they did a lot of research, and some of her cells have developed a lot of curing other diseases. It's a miracle. That's all I can say.
Then suddenly he yelled at the ground, as if he was talking directly to Henrietta.
They named them Gila, and they still livin'.
He kicked at the dirt again. A few minutes later, seemingly out of nowhere, he pointed to the dirt and said,
You know, white folks and black folks all buried on top of each other in here. I guess old white granddaddy and his brothers was buried in here, too. Really no telling who in this ground now.
Only thing he knew for sure, he said, was that there was something beautiful about the idea of slave-owning white laxes being buried under their black kin.
They spend an eternity in the same place, he told me, laughing. They must have worked out their problems by now.
Henrietta's great-great-grandmother was a slave named Morning. A white man named John Smith Pleasance inherited Morning and her husband George from his father, one of the first slaveholders in Clover. Pleasance's father came from a family of Quakers, and one of his distant relatives had been the first to fight successfully to free his own slaves through the Virginia courts. But Pleasance hadn't carried on the family's anti-slavery tradition. Morning and George were enslaved on a tobacco plantation in Clover. Their son, Henrietta's paternal great-grandfather Edmund, took his owner's last name, which lost the S to become Pleasant. He was eventually freed from slavery at the age of 40, only to be committed later to an asylum for dementia. But before he was freed, he fathered many children, all of them born into slavery, including a daughter named Henrietta Pleasant, the great-aunt of Henrietta Lacks. On the other side of Henrietta's family, her maternal great-grandfather was a white man named Albert Lacks, who'd inherited part of the Lacks plantation in 1885 when his father divided his land among his 3 white sons, Winston, Benjamin, and Albert. Winston Lacks was a burly man with a beard that grew to his belly. He drank almost every night in a saloon hidden in the basement beneath the general store. When Winston got drunk and started fighting, the locals knew it was time for the soberest man to ride and get Fanny. There are no records of Fanny's life, but she was most likely born a slave on the Lacks property, and like most Lacks slaves who stayed on the plantation as sharecroppers, she never left. She often rode beside Winston in his wagon, and when he got drunk, she'd march into the saloon, snatch him off the bar stool by his long beard, and drag him home. The other brothers, Albert and Benjamin, led more private lives and left behind little history aside from their wills and land deeds. Most of the black Lackses I talked to over the years referred to Benjamin Lacks as old white granddaddy, though some still called him Massa Ben, as their parents had. When Albert died on February 26, 1889, slavery had been abolished. But few black people owned land of their own. Albert's will left land to 5 colored heirs, most of it in 10-acre chunks, and one of those heirs was Henrietta and Day's grandfather, Tommy Lax. Albert's will said nothing of his relation to his heirs, but folks in Laxtown knew they were children he'd had with a former slave named Maria. After Albert's death, his brother Benjamin sued to take some of that land away from Albert's black heirs, saying that since it was his father's land originally, he had the right to choose whichever plot he wanted. The court agreed and divided the original Lax plantation into 2 plots of equal value. The lower section, on the river, went to Benjamin Lax. The upper plot, now known as Laxtown, went to the black Laxes. 16 years after the court case, when Benjamin Lax dictated his own will days before his death, he gave small plots of land to each of his sisters, then divided the remaining 124 acres and his horses between 7 colored heirs of his own, including his nephew, Tommy Lax. There's no record of Benjamin or Albert Lax marrying or having any white children. And as with Albert, there's no record that the black children in Benjamin's will were his own. But he called them his nigger children, and according to Black Lax oral history, everyone living on the land in Clover that was once the Lax plantation descended from those 2 white brothers and their black mistresses who were once slaves. When I arrived in Clover, race was still ever present. Roseland was the nice colored fellow who ran Rosie's before it shut down. Bobcat was the white man who ran the mini mart. Henrietta went to St. Matthew's, the colored church. One of the first things Cootie said when I met him was, "You don't act strange around me 'cause I'm black. You're not from around here." Everyone I talked to swore race relations were never bad in Clover. But they also said Laxtown was only about 12 miles from the local lynch tree, and that the Ku Klux Klan held meetings on a school baseball field less than 10 miles from Clover's main street until well into the 1980s. Standing in the cemetery, Cliff told me, "The white Laxes know their kin all buried in here with ours 'cause they family. They know it, but they'll never admit it. They just say, them black Laxes, they ain't kin." When I went to visit Carlton and Ruby Lax, the oldest white Laxes in Clover, they smiled and chit-chatted as they led me from their front door into a living room filled with pastel blue overstuffed chairs and Confederate flags, one in each ashtray, several on the coffee table, and a full-sized one on a stand in the corner. Like Henrietta and Day, Carlton and Ruby were first cousins before they became husband and wife. They were both related to Robin Lax, the father of Albert, Ben, and Winston Lax, which made them Henrietta and Day's distant cousins. Carlton and Ruby had been married for decades and had more children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren than they could count. All they knew for sure was that there were more than 100 of them. Carlton was a frail man in his late 80s, with skin so pale it looked almost translucent. Tufts of hair like overgrown cotton sprouted from his head, brow, ears, and nostrils as he sat in his easy chair, mumbling about his years working the bank at a tobacco warehouse. "I wrote out the checks," he said, mostly to himself. "I was the tobacco king." Ruby was in her late 80s, too, with a sharp mind that seemed decades younger than her frail body. She talked right over Carlton, telling me about their grandfather who'd farmed the Lax plantation and their relation to Ben and Albert Lax. When I mentioned that Henrietta came from Laxtown, Ruby straightened in her chair. "Well, that was colored," she snapped.
I don't know what you're talking about. You're not talking about coloreds, are you?
I told her I wanted to learn about both the white and black Laxes.
Well, we never did know each other, she said. The white and the black didn't mix then. Not like they do now, which I can't say I like because I don't think it's for the best.
She paused and shook her head.
Mixing them like that, during school and church and everything. They end up white and black, get together and marry and all. I just can't see the sense in it.
When I asked how she and Carlton were related to the black Laxes, they looked at each other from across the coffee table like I'd asked if they were born on Mars.
My daddy's uncle kept a lot of the colored Laxes as slaves, Ruby said. That must be where they got their name. Evidently, they took it when they left the plantation. That's the only thing I can figure.
Later, I asked Henrietta's sister, Gladys, what she thought of their theory. Though she'd lived about a mile from Carlton and Ruby Lax most of her 90 years, Gladys said she'd never heard of them.
Black and white Lax is kin, Gladys said. But we don't mix.
She pointed under the couch where I was sitting.
Get Lillian's letter,
she said to her son, Gary. As far as Gladys knew, all of Henrietta's other siblings were dead, except maybe Lillian, the youngest. The last anyone had heard from Lillian was a letter she'd sent sometime in the 80s, which Gladys kept in a shoebox under the couch. In it, Lillian wrote,
I heard Daddy died in a fire.
And she asked if it was true. It was. He died in 1969, 2 decades before she sent that letter. But what Lillian really wanted to know was who'd been talking to people about her life. She'd won the lottery, she said, and she believed someone was trying to kill her because white folks had been coming around asking questions about her life in Clover and her family, especially Henrietta.
They knew things I didn't even know, she wrote. I don't think anybody should talk about other people.
No one in the family had heard from her since.
Lillian converted to Puerto Rican,
Gladys said, holding the letter to her chest. I looked at Gary, who sat beside her.
Lillian's skin was real light, even lighter than Mom's,
Gary explained.
She married a Puerto Rican somewhere in New York. Since she could pass, she disowned her blackness, converted to Puerto Rican because she didn't want to be black no more.
Chapter 17. Illegal, Immoral, and Deplorable. 1954 to 1966. As Gila grew like crabgrass in laboratories around the world, a virologist named Chester Southam had a frightening thought. What if Henrietta's cancer cells could infect the scientists working on them? Guy and several others had already shown that some rats grew tumors when injected with live Gila. Why not humans? Researchers were breathing in the air around Gila cells, touching them and transferring them from vial to vial, even eating lunch at lab tables beside them. One had used them to grow a vaccine for a common cold-like virus, which he'd injected, along with bits of Gila, into more than 400 people. Yet no one knew whether a person could actually catch cancer from Gila or other cancer cells.
There is the possible danger, Southam wrote, of initiating neoplastic disease by accidental inoculation during laboratory investigation, or by injection with such cells or cell products if they should be used for production of virus vaccine.
Southam was a well-respected cancer researcher and chief of virology at Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research. He and many other scientists believed that cancer was caused by either a virus or an immune system deficiency. So Southam decided to use Gila to test those theories. In February 1954, Southam loaded a syringe with saline solution mixed with Gila. he slid the needle into the forearm of a woman who'd recently been hospitalized for leukemia, then pushed the plunger, injecting about 5 million of Henrietta's cells into her arm. Using a second needle, Southam tattooed a tiny speck of India ink next to the small bump that formed at the Gila injection site. That way, he'd know where to look when he re-examined the woman days, weeks, and months later to see if Henrietta's cancer was growing on her arm. He repeated this process with about a dozen other cancer patients. He told them he was testing their immune systems. He said nothing about injecting them with someone else's malignant cells. Within hours, the patient's forearms grew red and swollen. 5 to 10 days later, hard nodules began growing at the injection sites. Southam removed some of the nodules to verify that they were cancerous, but he left several to see if the patient's immune systems would reject them or the cancer would spread. Within 2 weeks, some of the nodules had grown to 2 centimeters, about the size of Henrietta's tumor when she went in for her radium treatments. Southam eventually removed most of the Gila tumors, and those he didn't remove vanished on their own in a few months. But in 4 patients, the nodules grew back. He removed them, but they returned again and again. In 1 patient, Henrietta's cancer cells metastasized to her lymph nodes. Since those patients all had cancer to begin with, Southam wanted to see how healthy people reacted to the injections, for comparison's sake. So in May 1956, he placed an ad in the Ohio State Penitentiary newsletter. Physician seeks 25 volunteers for cancer research. A few days later, he had 96 volunteers, which quickly increased to 150. He chose the Ohio prison because its inmates had cooperated in several other studies without resistance, including one in which they'd been infected with a potentially deadly disease called tularemia. Research on inmates would come under scrutiny and start being heavily regulated about 15 years later, because they'd be considered a vulnerable population unable to give informed consent. But at the time, prisoners nationwide were being used for research of all kinds, from testing chemical warfare agents to determining how X-raying testicles affected sperm count. Southam began injecting prisoners in June 1956 using Gila cells that his colleague, Alice Moore, carried from New York to Ohio in a handbag. 65 prisoners, murderers, embezzlers, robbers, and forgers, lined up on wooden benches for their injections. Some wore white hospital garb. Others came off work gangs wearing blue dungarees. Soon, tumors grew on the prisoners' arms just as they'd grown in the cancer patients. The press ran story after story about the brave men at the Ohio Penitentiary, praising them as the first healthy human beings ever to agree to such rigorous cancer experiments. They quoted one man saying, "I'd be lying if I said I wasn't worried. You lie there on your bunk, knowing you've got cancer in your arm? Boy, what you think about." Again and again, reporters asked, "Why did you volunteer for this test?" The prisoners' replies were like a refrain. "I done a girl a great injustice, and I think it'll pay back a little bit what I did to her. I believe the wrong that I have done in the eyes of society, this might make a right on it." Southam gave multiple cancer cell injections to each prisoner, and unlike the terminally ill patients, those men fought off the cancer completely. And with each new injection, their bodies responded faster, which seemed to indicate that the cells were increasing the inmates' immunity to cancer. When Southam reported his results, the press hailed them as a tremendous breakthrough that could someday lead to a cancer vaccine. In the coming years, Southam injected Gila and other living cancer cells into more than 600 people for his research, about half of them cancer patients. He also began injecting them into every gynecologic surgery patient who came to Sloan Kettering's Memorial Hospital or its James Ewing Hospital. If he explained anything, He simply said he was testing them for cancer, and he believed he was. Since people with cancer seemed to reject the cells more slowly than healthy people did, Southam thought that by timing the rejection rate, he might be able to find undiagnosed cases of cancer. In a statement he'd later repeat again and again during hearings about his research, Southam wrote, "It is, of course, inconsequential whether these are cancer cells or not, since they are foreign to the recipient and hence are rejected. The only drawback to the use of cancer cells is the phobia and ignorance that surrounds the word cancer." Because of that phobia and ignorance, Southam wrote, he didn't tell patients the cells were cancerous because he didn't want to cause any unnecessary fear. As he would say, "To use the dreaded word cancer in connection with any clinical procedure on an ill person is potentially deleterious to that patient's well-being, because it may suggest to him, rightly or wrongly, that his diagnosis is cancer or that his prognosis is poor. To withhold such emotionally disturbing but medically non-pertinent details is in the best tradition of responsible clinical practice." But Southam wasn't their doctor, and he wasn't withholding upsetting health information. The deception was for his benefit. He was withholding information because patients might have refused to participate in his study if they'd known what he was injecting. And Southam probably would have continued doing this for years had he not made an arrangement on July 5, 1963, with Emanuel Mandel, director of medicine at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn, to use the hospital's patients for his research. The plan was that Mandel would have doctors on his staff inject 22 JCDH patients with cancer cells for Southam. But when he instructed his staff to give the injections without telling patients they contained cancer cells, three young Jewish doctors refused, saying they wouldn't conduct research on patients without their consent. All three knew about the research Nazis had done on Jewish prisoners. They also knew about the famous Nuremberg trials. 16 years earlier, on August 20, 1947, a U.S.-led international war tribunal in Nuremberg, Germany, had sentenced seven Nazi doctors to death by hanging. Their crime was conducting unthinkable research on Jews without consent, sewing siblings together to create Siamese twins, dissecting people alive to study organ function. The tribunal set forth a 10-point code of ethics, now known as the Nuremberg Code, which was to govern all human experimentation worldwide. The first line in that code says, "The voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential." The idea was revolutionary. The Hippocratic Oath, written in the 4th century BC, didn't require patient consent. And though the American Medical Association had issued rules protecting laboratory animals in 1910, no such rules existed for humans until Nuremberg. But the Nuremberg Code, like other codes that would come after it, wasn't law. It was essentially a list of recommendations. It wasn't routinely taught in medical schools, and many American researchers, including Southam, claimed not to know it existed. Those who did know about it often thought of it as the Nazi Code, something that applied to barbarians and dictators, not to American doctors. When Southam began injecting people with HeLa cells in 1954, there was no formal research oversight in the United States. Since the turn of the century, politicians had been introducing state and federal laws with hopes of regulating human experimentation, but physicians and researchers always protested. The bills were repeatedly voted down for fear of interfering with the progress of science, even though other countries, including, ironically, Prussia, had enacted regulations governing human research as early as 1891. In the United States, the only way to enforce research ethics was in the civil courts. There, lawyers could use the Nuremberg Code to establish whether a scientist was acting within the ethical boundaries of the profession. But taking a researcher to court required money, know-how, and the knowledge that you were being used for research in the first place. The term informed consent first appeared in court documents in 1957, in a civil court ruling on the case of a patient named Martin Salgo. He went under anesthesia for what he thought was a routine procedure and woke up permanently paralyzed from the waist down. The doctor hadn't told him the procedure carried any risks at all. The judge ruled against the doctor, saying, "A physician violates his duty to his patient and subjects himself to liability if he withholds any facts which are necessary to form the basis of an intelligent consent by the patient to the proposed treatment." He wrote that there needed to be full disclosure of facts necessary to an informed consent. Informed consent focused on what doctors were required to tell their patients. There was little mention of how it might apply to research like Southam's, in which subjects weren't the researcher's patients. And it would be decades before anyone thought to ask whether informed consent should apply in cases like Henrietta's, where scientists conduct research on tissues no longer attached to a person's body. But to the three doctors who refused to help with Southam's research, injecting cancer cells into a person without consent was a clear violation of basic human rights and the Nuremberg Code. Mandel didn't see it that way. He had a resident give the injections in their place. And on August 27, 1963, the three doctors wrote a resignation letter citing unethical research practices. They sent it to Mandel and at least one reporter. When Mandel got the letter, he called a meeting with one of the doctors and accused them of being overly sensitive because of their Jewish ancestry. One member of the hospital's board of directors, a lawyer named William Hyman, didn't think they were being overly sensitive. When he heard about the doctor's resignation, he asked to see the records of the patients in the study, but his request was denied. Meanwhile, just days after the doctors resigned, the New York Times ran a tiny news item deep in the paper under the headline, "Sweden Penalizes Cancer Specialist," about a cancer researcher named Bertil Björklund. He'd been giving himself and patients intravenous injections of vaccines made from HeLa cells, which he'd gotten from George Guy's lab in such enormous quantities, they joked that instead of injecting them, Björklund could just fill a pool with HeLa, or maybe even a lake, and swim around in it for immunity. Björklund's HeLa injections got him expelled from his laboratory, and Hyman hoped for similar results with Southam. So in December 1963, he sued the hospital for access to medical records related to the study. Hyman compared Southam's study to Nazi research and got affidavits from the three doctors who'd resigned. They described Southam's research using words like illegal, immoral, and deplorable. Hyman also got an affidavit from a fourth doctor explaining that the patients in the study wouldn't have been capable of giving informed consent even if Southam had asked. One had advanced Parkinson's disease and couldn't talk. Others spoke only Yiddish. One had multiple sclerosis and depressive psychosis. Regardless, Hyman wrote, "I was informed that consent was not necessary, that it was unlikely that Jewish patients would agree to live cancer cell injections." That caught the media's attention. The hospital called the suit misleading and fallacious. But newspapers and magazines ran headlines saying, "Patients injected with cells not told they were cancer. Scientific experts condemn ethics of cancer injection." They said the Nuremberg Code didn't seem to apply in the United States, and that there were no laws protecting research subjects. Science magazine called it the hottest public debate on medical ethics since the Nuremberg trials, and said, "The situation at present appears rather perilous for everyone." A reporter from Science asked Southam why, if the injections were as safe as he swore they were, he didn't inject himself. "Let's face it," Southam responded,
There are relatively few skilled cancer researchers, and it seems stupid to take even the little risk.
Patients who'd unknowingly been injected with cancer cells by Southam read the articles and began contacting reporters. New York State Attorney General Louis Lefkowitz learned about Southam's research through the media as well, and immediately launched his own investigation. In a scathing 5-page document filled with exclamation points, he accused Southam and Mandel of fraud and unprofessional conduct, and demanded that the Board of Regents of the University of the State of New York revoke their medical licenses. Lefkowitz wrote, "Every human being has an inalienable right to determine what shall be done with his own body. These patients, then, had a right to know the contents of the syringe. And if this knowledge was to cause fear and anxiety or make them frightened, they had a right to be fearful and frightened and thus say no to the experiment." Many doctors testified before the Board of Regents and in the media on Southam's behalf, saying they'd been conducting similar research for decades. They argued that it was unnecessary to disclose all information to research subjects or get consent in all cases, and that Southam's behavior was considered ethical in the field. Southam's lawyers argued, "If the whole profession is doing it, how can you call it unprofessional conduct?" This rattled the Board of Regents. On June 10, 1965, its Medical Grievance Committee found Southam and Mandel guilty of fraud or deceit and unprofessional conduct in the practice of medicine, and recommended that their medical licenses be suspended for 1 year. The board wrote, "There is evidenced in the record in this proceeding an attitude on the part of some physicians that they can go ahead and do anything, and that the patient's consent is an empty formality. With this, we cannot agree." Their decision called for more specific guidelines in clinical research, saying, "We trust that this measure of discipline will serve as a stern warning that zeal for research must not be carried to the point where it violates the basic rights and immunities of a human person." The suspensions of Southam's and Mandel's licenses were stayed, leaving them both on 1-year probation instead, and the case seemed to have little impact on Southam's professional standing. Soon after the end of his probationary period, Southam was elected president of the American Association for Cancer Research. But his case brought about one of the largest research oversight changes in the history of experimentation on humans. Before the Board of Regents announced its decision, the negative press about Southam's work had gotten the attention of the NIH, which funded his research and required its investigators to get consent for all studies involving humans. In response to the Southam situation, the NIH investigated all their grantee institutions and found that only 9 out of 52 had any policy in place to protect the rights of research subjects. Only 16 used consent forms. The NIH concluded, "In the setting in which the patient is involved in an experimental effort, the judgment of the investigator is not sufficient as a basis for reaching a conclusion concerning the ethical and moral set of questions in that relationship." As a result of its investigation, the NIH said that to qualify for funding, all proposals for research on human subjects had to be approved by review boards, independent bodies made up of professionals and laypeople of diverse races, classes, and backgrounds, to ensure that they met the NIH's ethics requirements, including detailed informed consent. Scientists said medical research was doomed. In a letter to the editor of Science, one of them warned, "When we are prevented from attempting seemingly innocuous studies of cancer behavior in humans, we may mark 1966 as the year in which all medical progress ceased." Later that year, A Harvard anesthesiologist named Henry Beecher published a study in the New England Journal of Medicine showing that Southam's research was only one of hundreds of similarly unethical studies. Beecher published a detailed list of the 22 worst offenders, including researchers who'd injected children with hepatitis and others who'd poisoned